This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the monthly look at film, cult titles, and world cinema. In today's Halloween special, we're looking at the work of classic Italian horror film score composer Fabio Frizzi. The track which opened today's program was part of his score for Zombie Flesh Eaters. And later in the show, you'll hear excerpts from his scores for The Beyond and City of the Living Dead. Also in the second half of the show is a Q&A recorded at last year's Leeds Film Festival with the director of a more somber film about death rather than an exploitation title, as documentarian Justin Sheen is discussing his film Left on Purpose, a documentary which started out as a look at people who grow their own vegetables in New York communal gardening plots, but turned into an investigation of why a former activist now wanted to end his own life, preferably on camera. However, to start off with, here's Electric Film magazine editor Virginie Selvi in discussion with Fabio Frizzi and Spencer Hickman from Death Waltz Records discussing the scores of classic Italian horror movies.
When you started working with Franco Bixio and Vincenzo Tempera in the 60s, Did you always want to do soundtracks, or did you want to be in a rock or pop band?
Let's say that when a young man begins doing this wonderful trip, this music or art, I think in the beginning you don't know ever really what you want. The first love were obviously the bands, so maybe the very first idea was to sing, to play, to write songs and so. But I was very near to the cinema, because my dad was one person who was a producer, a distributor in Italy. So this. But everywhere there is written in the 60s. In fact, I started. There is a wrong information in Motu, IMDb, because the very first one was Amore Libero Free Love, and I was 22, so it's the beginning of the 70s. And Carlo Bixio was my publisher, So he was the man who, in a sense, discovered this young boy who wanted to do music. And Franco and Vincenzo were my... I started by myself, then after a couple of years, Carlo suggested me, why not to go with a group, you can grow better. And this was...
And you had composed a few soundtracks before you met Lucio Fulci, and you worked on Four of the Apocalypse in 1975. Why was that film so important in your career? And did it change the way you approached writing a film score?
This film was very important and is still very important because I link my answer to the question before. I wanted to write song, and this was, in a way, the possibility to begin, because Lucio, for that movie, wanted songs. He was in love with Bob Dylan, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and things like this. So he wanted, he asked to me, Vincenzo and Franco, to write songs for every situation, for every character of the movie. And this was, in fact, a way to do what I used to love and I couldn't more do, because when you write for movies, yes, one song every now and then, but not every day. The important is because Lucio, among the 100 people with whom I've worked, was and is and still is my maestro. I mean, the person who taught me, also in a not good way every time, how you have to approach to this, because it's not music, it's another thing, it's something that maybe we will talk after.
Uh-huh. Really? No, now if you want.
No, the approach to the movie is something. Sometimes when you grow and you have a young musician that asks you, can you listen this? Can you? And you listen good themes, good ideas, but the very important thing is not to hear good music. It to understand if that goes with that image, with an idea. They must go absolutely hand by hand, you must follow the first idea of the director. I mean, maybe you can like this song, this theme with that image. But if he doesn't like, if the producer is not, no, I wanted to say something different. You have to change, and you cannot fall in love with a theme. And this is maybe the most difficult thing for a composer of music for movies.
Yeah, because there was a song that you'd written. Was it for City of the Living Dead? That was a very, very lovely song, and then he refused to.
This was maybe the worst moment in all my career, but maybe it was the most important. Because you see, I think every son, every children has a difficult relationship with his parents, his father. But it's very. She knows something about. but in fact, if the relationship is correct, is clear. Sometimes the wall that you front is something good for you as a child, because you have to understand things that otherwise you couldn't understand. I can assure you that theme that. My friend has listened so many times in my concert, which is the title, the title track for Paura, was never used by Lucio because he hates this so much. And I can tell you that it was perfect for him, because I thought, after so long time we worked together, he can have a fate on me. He can't believe that I've... No, he wanted another, and it was so... Oh, so pretty. Like this, we were seated aside with the bad words in Italian.
He was notoriously difficult to work with.
It was.
But I mean, for everyone says. But he always got the job done.
Yeah, but you see, sometimes I think that when you are doing a movie, and sometimes you say, okay, let's do it like... Lucio never, with me at least, never did. Let's use this theme. No, I'm not so. No, it was a come si dice, absolute lover of his, and knew what he wanted. So if that went okay, you could see him very, very calm otherwise, but not only with music, with the effect, with voices, with the dubbing, with everything. But nowadays, after so many years, his movies are still good movies. You can appreciate also today.
Which one of his movies that you worked on is your favorite?
You know, every child is loved by his father, so every score. I can tell you that the second project that this year was born, which is the Beyond the Composer's Cut, maybe says that one I prefer is that one. The Beyond is a great movie with a complete story, with many actors, many situations, and I think with maybe the best in the sense that it is one of the scores I made the best way. There is orchestra, there is the band, the singers, the chorus, and there is Fabio Pignatelli who plays the bass. I mean, everything is into, and I decided to try to actualize that score. The real story is this one. One of my guitarists, one of my cooperators on a plane in the USA last year, told me, why don't we do something that, like many people do? Thank you so much. No. Doing a movie with the live score. Oh, thank you. And I say, you want to know why? Because I cannot imagine to be on the stage for 2 hours, 1 hour and a half, 2 hours, and play 20 minutes. It's crazy. It's not something I would like to do. I won't be a part of, like the piano player was in the 20s or the 30s. And he says, but it's your job. You could do it more longer. I say, why not? We came to Roma, and I said, let's try. Then we must say another friend of us, who is Bob Muraski. Bob is it's an editor, one of the most important editors in the world, Oscar Award, and so we met last year in L.A. He's crazy for Lucio. Really, he's a young.
He runs Grindhouse release. Yeah. As well. So he's just put out the Beyond Blu-ray special edition.
And you know what he did? When I told him, I have this idea to rewrite the score for a band, and I have also the option for the orchestra. And he says, I can send you the movie in Acadi HD. And after 10 days, I have the movie with the...
He sent you all the stems, so you can separate the dialogue.
Bravo. This. So I could do it. If I didn't have this, I couldn't start, because if you don't have the dialogue aside, how can you do? So I think that this is only the beginning of the idea. Now it's a show. But I think in the December, maybe in January, we will record the new, which is very similar to the old, but it's actualized. And there is one more theme that I wrote to link things that before were separate. And so it's maybe there is a movie, maybe there will be with Bob some distribution of it. I think it's an adventure. And you know what is quite which is buffo.
It's quite a joke.
That Lucio is like were always with us, you know, telling and laughing nowadays to some joke of children that we do at our age.
So is this? So the rescore is it, or it's not? You're still using the original themes,
no,
but with new music.
No,
I know you compose new music because you said.
Yeah, no, but just one theme. No, the real thing. It's something that I never told because we are starting. You know that things happen when they have to happen. So when I come back, I talk to Daniele, my manager, and we look for the original recording, and there are 52 songs, pieces of music, and I go through the movie after Bob sent me, and I say, but here I remember there was this one. In fact, Lucio, we did a lot of music. Then in the end, he sometimes only the effects, sometimes the without music. And I say, first of all, let's try to put the original that we decided together in the movie. So I take the single song and I put them in the right, like in a conversation, like in a psychological meeting with everybody of them. The editor is no more alive. Lucio is no more with us, but we work together in a way. Then in the end, I see ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, we need something here, something here, something. And I feel the position where I think that also in that moment we didn't have done the right choice. I mean, now I am 65. Then I was at 30. So something also as an artist has changed. And every time we have rehearsal, so many, and one concert to understand if it works in Italy. And I can't believe, you know, I am here with my band, the movie. We play. We are with a metronome, which lasts every for a movie. So we start with, and everything is perfect because I studied. It's really, and it is more difficult than the concert. You know why? Because in the concert, if you do a mistake, it happens. No, everybody follows. There, you have to go with the scene. If you are wrong for one beat, you are out. It's really, so it's a gamble. Uh-huh. That every time you play, starts again.
And what inspired the choral voices in the Beyond?
To comment with the music, every kind of movie, you must be in line. And you have if you do a good salad with perfect things, green, red, if you don't put some salt, some good Italian oil, okay, you can eat, but it changes completely. I think it's almost the same. You see the salad, it's beautiful, but if you put something more, and in a very dramatic movie like this, you enter the else door in the end. It's incredible. That scene still now beats me so much. It's incredible. Two people don't understand. He says the last word is impossible. It's impossible. It's catch you, no? So how can you describe this? I can tell you that I had written for chorus, but the idea of the words was from my conductor, from orchestra conductor, that told me, but why don't we let the chorus say something important? So we went to he was also a harmonium player in church, so he knew very well everything. He arrives with a little book, say, this phrase, Ugo da Celano was the author of this, the 1200, I mean, very, very old. So we try, no? Cum resurget creatura, it works. So we used to work with the images. It was very mechanical, so you had to, maybe you know very well, you had a machine, you had to... We tried on It was so beautiful. We had 8 women and 8 men. So we make some plans, you know, of this. And it was, you know, that I'm in love with the Mellotron usually. You know, Mellotron is, Mellotron in particular, the voices of Mellotron. Because human voice is so, is maybe the more interesting instrument, you know, because yes, it's a voice, but your voice, my voice, they're so particular. So I think it's giving also a recorded voice like Mellotron. I don't know who was the singer, and sometimes I wonder, really, who was the... somebody is, because no? It's a recording, so... And they are the heroes for me. Those people was the... because helped us so much.
So why are you so in love with the Mellotron? What is so special about it?
You know, the love with Mellotron started, why? Because we didn't have so much money to have orchestra, to have real chorus. So synthesizer and other things were born basically for this. Let's try to find some similar sound without spending money that we don't have. So Mellotron... I was in love with some situation that were born here in the UK, you know, Rolling Stones, Beatles, and many. And they had started using things like this, Genesis, with Watcher of the Skies, Mellotron. And so I started to be in love with this when I was 18, 19. I remember the first time I asked Carlo Bixio to rent, because I didn't have mine. Nowadays I have one, but in that time I didn't have. And I asked Carlo, can we rent a Mellotron? He said, it's useful. Yes, it is. And I called there is a musician negozio,
the
shop where they had a lot of, and they arrived at the Mellotron. With this cartridge, have you ever seen? Nowadays we have things that you put in the micro. This is an enormous, I think, couple of meters and 80 kilos, and you have to put track, and then it's fantastic. This, and I remember also the flutes that Beatles used and let me take you down, because I'm going strawberry fields
forever.
Right answer. Now, you know, everything comes from the passion. So if you have a passion and you have the chance to make your passion your life, you had won.
Synthesizers must have helped, though, because you had to work so quickly.
Yeah. Synthesizer. That was the moment they were born. I started in the beginning of the 70s, and that was the moment. So Solina to do strings, so Jupiter 8 that I love to still today. I have my old one. Of my other line is that instruments give you ideas. I know that also. I was talking about Genesis. What's your name, Lexi Vecchio Capo?
Phil Collins.
No,
the
first chief of Goblin. What's your
name?
Genesis. The idea of Genesis. What's your name? I will tell you after.
Peter Gabriel?
Eh?
Peter Gabriel.
Peter Gabriel. Yes. Peter Gabriel, once he told that he was, he used to write songs like this, having a good sound on a keyboard, and then rehearsing, trying to then maybe a drum machine aside. And you inspire yourself. But I say that also a different piano can give you different ideas. We have a school of music in Roma, and sometimes at 6 o'clock in the morning I go to write a theme when I'm all alone, we have four pianos. And sometimes I say, no, maybe this theme can be put with that one. Because they are like a real collaborator. Synthesizer is more or less like this. Me, my friends, you know, Maurizio Guarini, but not only him, many of my keyboardists in that moment had Fabio Pignatelli had some programmer, keyboard, and so. And this could give you so beautiful ideas. Zombie 2, it's done completely in something with orchestra that I wrote. But the other was me, a percussionist, Adriano Giordanella, and Maurizio Guarini with, and the themes were mine, but we have that lines written. Then what do we put here? And you start, and it's not so high, so freddo, so cold, no, because in some situation, synthesizer can become so live. So I think.
Spencer, what's your favorite of Fabio's scores? Very difficult question.
He doesn't lie.
I'd have to be a fan. I still have a super fondness for Zombie 2. Because that was the first movie that I saw with of yours with the score. And just being a kid into synths. And just remember it sounding amazing, which is why we chose it as our first ever release for the label. So...
This is one thing that was very important for me and for our friendship, because when there is a man that chooses something from you for beginning an important piece of his life, it gives you something, really. So every time I see that LP, I say, wow.
Yeah.
Right. Now, great moment, you know.
And it was just great to put it out. But it was like one of those records that, because the Beyond came out in a couple of versions. See the Living Dead came out. Those came out. They got released on Dago Red and a couple of other labels. But for some reason, Zombie never ever got released. It kind of, I can never understand why. It just felt like it was odd that it wasn't.
Me too.
I remember just sending Daniela an email.
Yeah,
he was like, "You want to release it on vinyl? Really? Yeah, go on. All right, whatever. You've got to pay me up front though, because I don't trust anyone." And then, from there, we've got another three records in the can that we're going to release with Fabio, and then obviously this tour we're doing in the States.
But there is something that I want you will do in the future. The very difficult thing is nowadays to let people love something new, and thanks to Lucio, thanks to everybody of our friends, in the last years I did something new, and I really hope that now you've sent Frankenstein that I do in concert from my friend of New York, Scooter McRae.
Okay.
And I think that there is a lot of more to say.
Yeah.
Forgetting Lucio and those things, but going ahead also, because there are not so many. There are many good composers today, enormous with orchestra, but writing scores for an horror movie, you can be also a little banale.
Banal?
Si, sure. You know, not. Okay, it's done. Okay. Perfect. But you should have some idea. And sometimes, nowadays, I think we sit on the story. And this is not correct, I think. We must always be with Lucio aside. With one Lucio Fulci aside.
Virginie Sellevy's interview with Fabio Frizzi and Spencer Hickman was recorded at this year's Frightfest. And you can find more information about Frightfest by going to frightfest.co.uk. And you can find more information about Death Waltz Records by going to deathwaltzrecordingcompany.com. And it's worth signing up to Death Waltz's monthly email newsletter to find out about releases of classic horror film scores on vinyl and other formats. You're listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. If you're just joining us, I'm afraid you've missed Virginie Sellevi's interview with Italian film composer Fabio Frizzi, but this will be available soon as a podcast from electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. To give you a flavour of Fabio Frizzi's music, here's an extract from his score for The Beyond. Coming up next in today's show is a Q&A recorded at last year's Leeds Film Festival with director Justin Shine, who's discussing his film Left on Purpose, a documentary about his discovering a retired activist in New York who not only wants to end his own life, but if preferable, do it on camera, and explores the nuances of how a documentary filmmaker might become too involved with his subject and so alter the events of the film that he is currently capturing on tape. The subject of Left on Purpose is a former activist called Maya Vishner, a counterculture protester who had been active in various anti-war demonstrations since the 1960s, such as being a member of the War Resisters League. He most famously became a core member of the Youth International Party, otherwise known as the Yippies, alongside Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and others. And his involvement in these various groups made him a prominent protester around the time of Vietnam, even if he didn't always have his face in the spotlight, preferring others to take the stage in front of him. In Left on Purpose, Maya Vishner finally does take centre stage, as he methodically and morbidly plans his own death, while forming a friendship with the filmmakers who he wants to document this grisly process.
Was it difficult to edit this film? How much of the structure came out in the editing process?
Well, you know, documentaries are often largely created in editing, and I was very close to the material, and so I really relied on my friend and editor David Melman to, you know, help make the film, and that's why he's a co-director, because he really played an important part. We had about 150 hours worth of footage, which sounds like a lot, but for 4 years of shooting, it actually it's not as much as you imagine.
Did you find now that you've been through the editing process and a couple of years have gone by and the film's finished and you're sharing it with audiences that Mayo was right when he predicted that you would feel differently about it?
Well, he was predicting that I would feel differently, that I would regret that I didn't have footage of his death. I'm glad that I made that decision. When it became clear to me that he wanted the camera in his apartment to film his death, I felt like that was too much of a contribution, too much of an encouragement. And when I told him I was taking it out, I think that's what angered me. It only kind of proved to me that, that's what it was. You know, I said to him, if you really want footage of your death, go ahead and film it, but I'm not going to do it for you. And, you know, I don't want to have regrets. And I don't have regrets, and I feel like it was a difficult process, but I feel like I don't have any regrets about my role in his life at that.
It's very interesting the way that you include the ethical dilemma in the way that the film is made right from the beginning. I was just wondering, in connecting with that question, whether you feel differently at the time, because in some way it's like, it seems like it's an unresolvable ethical dilemma. There's no perfect answer to it.
Sure. Well, you know, I've worked on a lot of documentary films, and I feel like even the most kind of benign subject has ethical problems. You know, to all documentaries, whenever you're pointing a camera at somebody, there's this power dynamic. And so, obviously, this was heightened in life or death, but I feel like this is just an exaggeration of those situations, and that, as a filmmaker, is interesting to me. And I felt like that's an important part, of an important layer to the story. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Do we have any questions?
How did it, I can platform over the beginning, how did you get involved in it in the first place?
Okay. How did I meet Mayor? I had made another film called No Impact Man, and Mayor had a small place in that film. He was the community gardener, his family was trying to live without environmental impact. And so we got to be friends there, and whenever I showed that film, people would be like, tell me more about Mayor. And I had grown up in the 80s, you know, as a teenager, looking back at the 60s and kind of wishing there was more activism and being and interested in activism. So I wanted to make a film about Mayer's life and his history as an activist, not imagining that.
And at that point, did you know that he
was? No, I did not know. It was really 6 months into the filming. I mean, slowly it became clear. But at first it felt like kind of like a Jewish Grey Gardens. I don't know if you know the Grey Gardens, but it's a great documentary. It's about this kind of brilliant decay. But I didn't, you know how badly the situation was until a little bit later. And then I don't think I would have continued if he weren't seeing doctors and psychiatrists. You know, if I wouldn't have been comfortable with that secret. And his doctors and his friends felt like the filming was a kind of positive thing for him, which kind of
obviously was from what he said.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I think it was positive, but in some ways I do think it was also, you know, I think it extended his life and maybe guaranteed his death anyway, because I feel like he wanted to provide the ending in a way. Yeah, I mean, according to Mayer, you know, there's a lot of great moments that didn't make the movie. You know, there's only so much Mayer in his underwear you could take. He had to make some tough decisions. But according to Mayer, he had been thinking about this for years before and planning it. And, you know, his doctors as well corroborated that, because I didn't know how serious he could take it. You know, up until close to the end, I thought that it may just be his way of getting attention.
You have talked about the film, and the art, the kind of connected to it, and that had come up.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
So, did you ever talk about, like, Hoffman?
I think Mayer's situation was kind of a number of conditions coming together at one, and certainly he was clinically depressed. His whole life. And then the fact that he had close friends at Abby Hoffman and Phillips and Tom Fashad that killed themselves. There's this concept in the kind of suicide psychology world of suicide contagion, where if somebody close to you takes their life, that it just dramatically increases your possibility to because it would have that as an option. So that, I feel like, contributed, and the drinking contributed. So all those things came together. And then, you know, he was a troublemaker. You told him he couldn't do something, it made it interesting to him. So. But I think at its heart, it's about depression.
Why was it that his name isn't well known? Like, I mean, I grew up on part of that, and I know those other people, and I've never heard of him.
Well, you know, he was kind of more of a foot soldier. He was shy in a way, and he was younger. And I mean, when Abbie Hoffman said, "Don't trust anybody over 30," I mean, he was over 30 when he said that. You know? So, Mayer was not. Was more of a housing
guy. Thank you for wearing funds or involving funds to make that more about his life. Do you see the university of Chicago as well? Do you think we'll see a documentary that tells us more about the early part of the early stages?
The history?
Yeah, what do you want to make?
Well, I don't think I'm done, but I mean, I think that young people today, I mean, I think people under 40, even in the United States, don't know much about the Yippies. As opposed to the civil rights movement, the Yippies were so counterculture and so devoted to irony that they don't have a recorded history. And I'm hoping that this film in some way contributes to renewing some interest. There's a number of films now about that time. I mean, these people are growing old now and telling their stories. Hopefully, I mean, there was a film called The Chicago 10 about the trial of Abbie Hoffman after the Chicago convention. That's a really interesting film. It's worth seeing. It's an animated documentary.
It's interesting to see the scene where he's at the Occupy movement and he's talking to the younger activists. I just thought it was interesting to point out that scene where he's at the Occupy movement and he's talking to the younger activists.
Oh, yeah.
And so the fact that you're saying a lot of young people don't know about the Yippie movement, and that there's lots of potential interest.
Yeah.
Perhaps with that connection.
I mean, I had hoped that the Occupy movement would kind of reinvigorate him, because I feel like he had so much to offer that movement and that generation. But I think that's part of depression, where instead of seeing an opportunity, he saw it as proof that he wasn't needed anymore. Kind of a glass is half empty, not half full. So he saw it as a sign that he could go now to. Yes, there were people kind of handing off the torch in a sense.
I mean, first of all, it was absolutely, really sort of fantastic film, very sort of powerful. And it's a fantastic, fantastic work. But one of the things that I was thinking of is that often, I mean, I sort of make sort of short films and short documentaries, and sometimes the accusation could be that the filmmaker is sort of controlling or can potentially manipulate the subject. But it seemed like, in terms of ethics, like there was a, you know, I imagine you didn't feel initially that you were going to go in as deep as you did, but I don't know what your thought on was. Almost, you know, as I say, the common assumption is the filmmaker can edit, whether it's through the edit or filming, manipulate the subject, but it's in some ways it was a lot grayer.
It's very clear that Mayer had an agenda and was using me to tell a story, and I feel like, you know, that's always part of the contract in a way. So I find that to be fascinating too, that Mayer was, that we were both had an agenda. I mean, I struggled trying to tell the story, and he, you know, was trying to. He was masterful in getting me to tell his story. I mean, I think you could make the argument that the suicide attempt where he just drank vodka was his way of getting my attention, because I had a baby and wasn't as focused on him, because it's not really the way you kill yourself. But slowly it became clear that he was kind of just disengaging from the world. And there was nothing that I could do. You know, putting him in the hospital, I didn't feel like it was a humane thing to do. Because he had been in the hospital before, and his doctor didn't feel that way either. So.
Did you ever feel used by him?
I mean, sure, you know, but in the end, it's I'm an edit room, so, and I think that there's, you know, something to be said about the film subject having a say and having an agenda, because it's, you know, all too often that filmmakers take advantage of people, so.
I suppose in order to somewhat deal with the ethical dilemma you had to make yourself part of the film as well, because it was about your struggle. Therefore, you put yourself not only in terms of the voiceover on screen as part of the subject, but I suppose you took that to the next level by also involving your family.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that I couldn't hide behind the camera in this film, and that would be too ethically problematic, and I wanted to kind of show that it became part of my life. I'd never made a film that my voice was in, let alone my family, but I felt like this, it had to be part of it, and in some ways it's one of the most interesting parts is my dilemma, so yeah.
Did you realize that quickly as you were making the film, or did that emerge later?
I mean, certainly in the beginning I was not planning on necessarily being in it. So like in that early scene where I deliver the beer to him, I'm talking to him and the camera's running, but I'm not even hardly pointing it at him because I didn't expect that I would use that. But as soon as it became about his possible suicide, I knew that I had to be in it. And in fact, I filmed scenes of me talking to lawyers and ethicists and people like that, which, you know, in the end felt a little too much. So,
Is there anyone who knew Maya who didn't want to be in the film?
One of his brothers did was very had lots of reservations and did not give me permission until he saw the rough cut.
Right.
And they're very supportive now. Yes, there are people that you know, there are a few friends. Bob Fast, who I filmed, he's a radio personality in New York and was kind of the voice of the movement in the 60s. You know, he feels guilty and he feels unsure about the whole project. So, I mean, we're going to show it in New York City for the first time next week. And a lot of those people will be there and we'll see. They feel about it. It played up at Woodstock, New York, last month, and people really kind of felt familiar and enjoyed the film. So we'll see. I'm interested to get all kinds of reactions. I know that it's. In the United States, the suicide rate for men near to age has doubled in the past 10 years. There's a real increase in the suicide rate. Part of that is the rate of people growing older. Part of that, I think, is the generation who live life kind of, you know, with their hands on the wheel and they're not going to die, you know, passively either. And part of it is, I think, drugs and alcohol, too. So it's complicated. But, you know, hopefully this will create some discussion.
You said you spoke to lawyers. I mean, in this country, I'm not entirely sure what the legal situation is, but I suspect that if you are very sure that someone's going to commit suicide and you don't report that to the police, you might then actually be questioned yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried about that at first, and the lawyers I spoke to felt that I certainly should not participate in any way, not that I would have, but that in the end that I wasn't going to be. I mean, it is illegal to aid and abet suicide. But there are some lawyers that say, you know, getting arrested is the best thing you can do for your movie. Probably would be true, but that's not my
I mean, I suppose if you'd followed him with a camera from store to store as he was stockpiling Advil or whatever, then maybe that would have made you more complicit.
And so I asked him not to tell me those details, even though he told me them unsolicited. And when I had a feeling that he was going to do that, I told him on the airplane back from Texas that if you need help, you need to call the police and not me, because I don't want to be responsible for your life or death. So it's a tough one.
I mean, just one point. I was sure. Thinking about. I think, as you say, it was certainly not your intention to maybe sort of go in as deep as when you first. First started the film, but I think, you know, where you went with it, it does answer, well, not answer, but open a lot of important questions about sort of assisted dying, about depression, about suicide. And I think it's a really, you know, I hope for those reasons, and for the works that charities like that do, you know, I don't think if you went out to make that film, you would have been able to make it. And I think sort of showing, you know, a lot of those, raises a lot of those questions, a lot of those debates. And I think it can, you know, be a really sort of important film.
Thank you. I hope so. I mean, it's kind of in the middle of the debate. You know, I think that the pro euthanasia people find this a little problematic because they want to focus on terminally ill people and not mental illness.
But that muddies the water a bit. Did your attitude to suicide change or to that kind of over the period of your experience?
I mean, I had never had any experience with suicide before this. Sadly, after Mayer died, I had a friend that took his own life. But I think I did a lot of talking to people during the making of the film. I think it showed me that the concept of suicide is a very broad one, and then to sum it up with one word doesn't do it justice, and that there's different situations. I mean, I feel like Mayer was very much, even though he was depressed, and you know, he had a good understanding of what he was doing. You know, a younger person or somebody that hasn't been treated by a doctor, and I feel that's a very different situation. So I would say that the term suicide doesn't really cover it.
Because in this country, there is, like you're referring to, Dignity in Dying.
Sure.
But there's also an organisation called Old Age Rational Suicide Society. So, you know, people who say,
sure,
and I happen to be a member of that,
yeah,
which is saying, no, it's a perfectly rational thing to do,
yeah,
at a certain time in life.
Sure. I mean, that's what makes us human, is the ability to know that we are mortal. And part of that is, control that in a way.
A really good contribution, I think, your film is to the debate and to the issues raised by it. And it's very human, you know, difficult to watch at times.
Yeah.
But very human. Thank you.
The film Left on Purpose shows that the suicide of an individual is a terrible and disruptive act. And if you've been affected by any of the issues discussed in this interview, there are various ways of seeking help through a variety of websites on the internet. The Samaritans can be found at www.samaritans.org, and the Campaign Against Living Miserably, CALM, can be found at thecalmzone.net. The charity Papyrus, which deals with the prevention of young suicide in the UK, can be found at papyrus-uk.org, and they have a presence on Twitter, papyrus_tweets. You can find more information about the documentary Left on Purpose by going to leftonpurpose.com, where you can order a DVD for educational purposes. And the documentary Left on Purpose will be available to download via video on demand from the 10th of February 2017 via various platforms including iTunes, Amazon Video, the Microsoft Streaming Store, and Google Play. In the meantime, for more information about the movie, please go to their website, leftonpurpose.com. For more information about this year's Leeds International Film Festival, which takes place between the 3rd and the 17th of November, please go to leedsfilm.com. And there are movies showing throughout the city at such venues as the Belgrave Music Hall, City Varieties, the Everyman Leeds, Hyde Park Picture House, Leeds City Museum, and the Leeds College of Art, amongst many other venues. Films include retro screenings of such titles as 2001 and Aliens, the latter accompanied by a live score, and local premieres of such films as A Journey Through French Cinema, A Monster Calls, United Kingdom, Certain Women, Chirac, Francesca, and many more. Fans of cult cinema will find much to enjoy, with titles ranging from the classic third installment of George Romero's zombie trilogy, Day of the Dead, and the magic roundabout movie, Dougal and the Blue Cat. You can buy passes for all films or individual tickets, including a 6-for-5 discount card, by going to leedsfilm.com. Before that, in London, Virginie Sellevy will be looking at the work of female cult film directors at the Barbican on Saturday the 29th of October at 3 p.m, looking at the work of such creators as Stephanie Rothman and Barbara Peters. You can find tickets and more information at www.barbican.org.uk/film. And later that evening, at the Union Chapel in Islington, Fabio Frizzi will be playing a selection of his film scores in the atmospheric venue, and that's on Saturday the 29th of October. The Electric Sheep Film Show was recorded, edited and introduced by Alex Fitch, with the interview with Spencer Hickman and Fabio Frizzi conducted by Virginie Sellevy. You can find all previous episodes of the Electric Sheep Film Show by going to electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events, and we'll be back on the third Wednesday of next month at 5:30 p.m. To play out, here's an extract from Fabio Frizzi's score for City of the Living Dead. Thanks for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.